Right now, 69 Kenosha, 68 Racine, 64 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack Andrea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Before we get to today's guest, we need to observe a very important and poignant anniversary here at WGTD. And to do so, I want to replay for you the first couple of minutes of the morning show that aired 20 years ago today, on September 20th, 1999, when the WGTD family lost a very important friend.
I'm Gregory Berg. I'm the Fine Arts Director here at WGTD. And I have an announcement that I need to make that I very much regret having to make. We received a phone call here at the radio station earlier this morning from the family of WGTD News Director Bill Guy. I'm sorry to announce that Bill passed away earlier this morning, approximately 3 o'clock. Bill was 50 years old. And he is survived by his wife, Linda, by a number of family members, and by many friends, and by many admirers who have enjoyed his work and benefited from his work here at WGTD over the years. With us today on the morning show, this was already scheduled, is Mike Schumacher, Kenosha author, who was one of Bill's favorite guests here on the morning show. Mike has paid us a number of visits over the years, and we scheduled this a few days ago, wanting to talk about the craft of the interview and to, along the way, pay tribute to Bill Guy. And it was not intended to be a memorial tribute, but that is what it is going to become. Incidentally, my conversation with Bill's brother-in-law this morning was quite brief. At that point, he was not indicating anything about funeral arrangements and so on. But we will certainly pass those on to you as soon as we are aware of them. The reason I invited Mike Schumacher to come onto the morning show today is because when we had a conversation at Bill's suggestion to have Mike come on and talk about his upcoming book about Francis Ford Coppola, we just got to talking about the visits that he had made to the morning show over the years. And Mike pointed out that of all the times he's been interviewed over the years by all three major networks, by journalists both here and abroad, of everybody who has ever interviewed him, his favorite was our own Bill Guy. So I wanted Mike Schumacher to come on the morning show today and talk a little bit about that, about what made Bill Guy such an exceptionally fine interviewer. So, Mike, first of all, I'm sorry about the circumstances under which you visit us today, but we're grateful that you can be here on the morning show.
Well, it's always good to be here. I mentioned to Bill I had the happy opportunity to tell him while he was alive, on a couple of occasions, and I had the opportunity to talk with you, of course, about all this, that I thought Bill was by far the finest interviewer I'd ever spoken to in any of the medium or media. And it's hard to define why sometimes, other than the fact that he obviously had a great passion for what he did. When you came in to talk to him, he cared about radio, about doing interviews. He was smart enough to do a little research before you came in. You can't imagine how many times on this end of the microphone I've been interviewed by people who weren't at all prepared. Bill not only prepared, but he seemed to be genuinely interested in what he was reading. He made you feel very, very comfortable when you were sitting opposite him, which is something that a lot of interviewers can't do. In some cases, you have interviewers who they think they're the story, and you're always trying to fight to get a word in edgewise. That's always been one of my complaints, incidentally, about even the big ones. Somebody like Oprah Winfrey is always interrupting her guests, you know, and they can never get a word in because she's the story. Bill was never the story. Bill would sit across from you in the booth, and there was something about him. He'd be smiling. The little things, the body English. He just was very easy to talk to. And then, this is probably the most important of it, he was real smart. He asked very intelligent questions. You cannot believe some of the questions that you get asked in the course of many interviews. And some of them are just obvious. Sometimes you have to ask the obvious question, but you have to find a way to frame it so you're not insulting the person you're talking to. Bill was very, very adept at that. He always made you feel like it's your story. Tell it your way. I'm just here for the ride. And I appreciated that. Plus, he was just a terrific guy.
That was Kenosha-based author Michael Schumacher offering his reminiscences of longtime WGTD news director Bill Guy, who also created the morning show and preceded me as its host. Bill Guy died on September 20th, 1999, so 20 years ago today. This very special morning show is going to be shared in its entirety on the Morning Show podcast tomorrow. It is available on all of the major podcast platforms, Spotify, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast. Search for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. And tomorrow you can hear this very special Morning Show tribute to my colleague and friend, Bill Guy, via the Morning Show podcast. I hope you will take the opportunity to seek out that program and hear it. And the time now is exactly 8:18. And I'm pleased to welcome into our WGTD studios for today's Friday morning show, Robert Haggerty Jr. And Robert Haggerty's father is Bob Haggerty, whose voice is heard nearly every weekday over the noon hour as part of the Midday News Report. And Bob Haggerty is active in other undertakings here at WGTD, including Gateway Sports Web. And so his voice is familiar to many of you. He actually reached out to WGTD General Manager Dave Cole to tell us about the really interesting and important work that his son Robert has been doing as a volunteer for an advocacy group called Raise the Voices. We're going to find out a little bit about Robert Haggerty Jr., where he has been studying, what his hopes are for his professional life, and of course, talk about this really important work that he is doing right now. Robert Haggerty, we welcome you to the morning show.
Hi, Greg. Thank you so much for having me on.
I'm really glad that you are here. Tell us just a little bit first about growing up in the Haggerty household and a little bit of what we need to know between date of birth and your arrival here in our studios today.
Oh, man. So I am the oldest of five children. I'm 29 years old. Like you said, my father is Bob Haggerty, who does some stuff here on the radio shows. And I just graduated from DePaul University with a master's degree in public administration. So I've been, you know, looking for work, and during that time, I've been trying to find ways to implement my degree, and I started looking for different volunteer work after I graduated, and just kind of happened to find on this this website called volunteermatch.org an opportunity with this group, Raise the Voices. So I signed up and became a team lead, and now I've been working to try and help a family that is here in the United States that declared political asylum and defected from China to get back into contact with a couple of their family members that have been disappeared into what China is calling re-education camps.
It's a disturbing story. We'll get to that in just a second. Let's hear first more about, a little more overall about this group called Raise the Voices. And what is the purpose of this organization and the kind of work that they do, even beyond the specific team that you are part of?
Okay, yeah. So Raise the Voices is an advocacy group, but it's an online advocacy group. So we have people from all around the world. I mean, we have people from Taiwan, Australia, the United States, some people in Europe that are doing work with us as well. And we do a lot of different work on a lot of different topics. I mean, we have the team that I work on, which is the Uyghur team, but then we also have a team that works on human trafficking. We have a team that is doing stuff with people who have been disappeared in Saudi Arabia. We have a team that is doing work on what's going on the southern border of the United States right now. So it's pretty broad. And we do mostly advocacy work, so reaching out to media, reaching out to different nonprofit organizations, human rights organizations, different organs of the U.S. government, and essentially trying to tell the stories of the people that we're representing, because you know it's important. Human rights are really important.
So. About as important as anything can be. It's certainly fundamental to who we are. And it sounds like the group is really working hard to live up to its name, Raise the Voices, because in many cases we're talking about voices that in one way or another have been silenced.
Yeah.
You, in a couple of moments in this interview already, have made reference to the Uyghur team, which you head up right now. And until we chatted this morning, I had to confess to being completely unfamiliar with this term. So we need to spend a few minutes talking about who the Uyghur are, and
yeah.
and then start exploring, in a sense, their plight in the nation of China right now.
Yeah, so the Uyghurs are a Muslim minority group that are in China, and they're mainly concentrated in the Xinjiang region of China, which is the most northwestern region of China. It's also the biggest region in China, and there's about 8 million Uyghurs in total, and about 6 million of them are adults.
And are they limited to China? I mean, is this term refer to Muslims that live in China, or they're Uyghur that live in other places?
I believe there's Uyghur that live in other places, but they really are mostly concentrated in China and mostly concentrated in the Xinjiang region of China.
And is this a group in which there is something about their beliefs or their practices that sets them apart from, in a sense, mainstream Muslims, mainstream Islam, or what is it that makes them Uyghur?
Well, they have their own language.
Their own language
is Uyghur. It's a almost like a dialect or an offshoot of Turkish in a lot of ways, because it actually, their country used to be called East Turkestan. That's what the Xinjiang region of China is. And in 1949, China essentially took it over because it's very mineral rich. It's, you know, it's very large. Like I said, it's the largest region in China. And so, you know, they wanted it essentially.
Yeah. Interesting. And so they number in I mean, you said 8 million or so in China. Of course, in a nation as populous as China, that is a relatively small number of people.
Yeah.
And it sounds like they are a very beleaguered minority. Give us, if you can, some sort of history of the way in which the Uyghur have been dealt with in China. I mean, from the start, has life been difficult for them in China?
So when China took over the Xinjiang region, they started to build schools, and they were really, it seemed, open to allowing them to speak their own language, allowing them to practice, you know, in their mosques and have their mosques and you know, practice their own religion. But I believe it was in the 1990s we started to see what China said was essentially an uptick in Muslim terrorism. And so, you know, there were cars being set on fire and there was some stuff that was happening. But essentially what has happened now is in those schools, they're no longer allowed to speak Uyghur. A lot of their language has started to be axed from the curriculum. And instead of speaking Uyghur, they want them to speak Mandarin. And they don't want them to practice their religion. A lot of the mosques in the Xinjiang region of China have actually been demolished. There's a BBC documentary, I think, actually, where you can see the before and after satellite footage of the place that these mosques were and now all of a sudden aren't anymore.
Wow.
So they've been demolished, you know, and really there's been quite a bit of oppression that's been happening since the 90s, and Uyghurs have started to really disappear into these, you know, quote, re-education camps since April 2017.
Wow. Describe, if you would, the nature of these re-education camps, and if we were on television, the viewers would see you doing sort of air quotes around the term re-education camp, and of course, that kind of a term is very sadly reminiscent of other sorts of camps we can think of that are given benign names that mask a much more sinister purpose. What do we know about these re-education camps, and are we to some extent left to sort of guess or surmise what's actually happening there?
Yeah, I mean, they're not good. They're essentially concentration camps is what they are. And like I said before, or maybe I haven't mentioned this yet, there's estimates by the UN that say that 1.5 to 2 million Uyghurs are in these camps right now. There's 6 million adult Uyghurs, so that's 1 in 4 adult Uyghurs are in these concentration camps, and they're, for the most part, not allowed to leave. You know, they have crying time. So once every 2 weeks, they get an hour or two where they're told, you know, you can cry now. And but I mean, a lot of them say, at least with the interviews that I've read, that during that time they can't even cry because it's humiliating. You can't just be told on command to cry. You cry when you feel sad and when you actually feel the need to do that. So, I mean, that's one thing. They're decimating their language. They're making them learn Mandarin instead of letting them speak their own language instead of letting them speak Uyghur. I mean, they're essentially committing cultural genocide is really what's happening in the name of, you know, again, air quotes, uniting China.
Right.
So
we're not talking about the whole scale murder of these Uyghur, or I mean, not in that sense is this genocide. This is a, as you say, a cultural genocide in which it appears that the government of China wants to completely assimilate these Uyghur into the country as a whole, wants to wipe out their culture, their religion, all that makes them unique and distinct as Uyghur.
Yeah.
China wants to do away with all of that
to
whatever extent it's possible.
So yes and no. Again, this isn't something that's new to China, right? If you look at Tibet, look at what they've done with the religions in Tibet. There's a bunch of different minority religions and minority cultures in China that they're trying to essentially wipe out and make everyone into Han Chinese, which is what most people, at least around here, think of when you think of someone that is Chinese. It's the predominant culture in China.
Right.
The reason I said yes or no, or yes and no, to it being both a cultural genocide and a regular genocide is because, yes, while they are trying to wipe out the culture of the Uyghurs and of many other minority groups within China, there's also people dying in these camps. I've got four names of people that have really recently died in the camps. There's someone named Alamjan Ahmet, who was 22, and he was repeatedly beat, and he died in interrogation while he was in a camp in Kashgar. There's two Uyghur brothers, Idris Kunduz, who was 53, and his younger brother, who's 45 years old, and his name was Hazim Kunduz, and they died in December 2018 and in June of this year for unspecified causes. And there was another person, Kaharjan Kawul, who was 41 and died in Aksu City and was arrested by the CCP or the Chinese Communist Party after they learned that more than 10 years prior to him being arrested, he'd actually visited family members in Turkey. And there's certain countries that are blacklisted for Uyghurs. They're not allowed to go to certain, it's mostly like predominantly Muslim countries that they're not allowed to go to because China is afraid that it's going to spur terrorism, essentially. At least that's the official, you know, thing that they're saying.
Wow. So there is death occurring in this practice as well. So it is a disturbing situation. How many Uyghur, did you say, are most likely interred right now in these re-education camps? Do we have at least a rough estimate?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely over a million. UN estimates originally put it at around a million, but that was a little while ago, and more recent estimates have put it at around 1.5 million, perhaps even 2 million people. And like I said before, there's 6 million Uyghur adults that are in the Xinjiang region of China. That's one in four adults that are in the camps.
Can you explain why someone ends up in one of these camps? I guess I don't mean that. I mean, you've explained the purpose of the camps, but why is it that these particular Uyghur are in these camps versus other Uyghur that, at least for the moment, are not in these camps? Are they brought there, in a sense, because they're charged with something or because they have done something that has triggered this act to be taken on them? Or is it more capricious than that in terms of who ends up in these re-education camps?
So, to be totally honest, it's really hard to tell. In a lot of ways, it really seems random. I can tell you that the three family members of the family that I'm representing, one of them is a predominant Uyghur scholar and a Uyghur linguist, and we think that's the reason that he ended up in the camps. Mm. His name is Husanjan Askar, and he was the chair of the terminology office, and he was a senior translator, and he was arrested in 2018. The second person in the family, Bahram Yarmuhammat, he was arrested in October of 2016, and we really don't have a reason for his arrest. We just know that the Chinese authorities put him in one of the concentration camps in Xinjiang. And then the third gentleman, whose name is Ikram Yarmuhammat, The reason that we have for his arrest is essentially just because he is a Uyghur young man. And so that's kind of why it's really hard to tell a lot of the time why exactly certain Uyghurs have been arrested and certain Uyghurs have not. And it might be that they had close ties to someone who was a Uyghur scholar. It might be, because they have close ties to people that have defected from China and are now living in the United States. It could be for a whole different myriad of reasons. Sometimes it's really just impossible to tell why they pick exactly the people who they're picking. But it's quite a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So,
for those of you just joining us, my guest on the morning show today is Robert Haggerty Jr. If that name sounds familiar, if you listen to WGTD with any regularity, you very often hear the voice of Robert's father, Bob Haggerty, who, among other things, is featured each and every weekday during the Midday News Report. Robert Haggerty Jr. Has been working for a nonprofit organization, Raise the Voices, which I believe operates under the auspices of a much larger group called CivWorks. Raise the Voices is seeking to tell the story and advocate on behalf of people who have either disappeared altogether or have fallen into internment camps of one kind or another. And Robert, you were mentioning that you are specifically working with are leading actually the Uyghur team working on this particular story in China, but that Raise the Voices has other projects in a sense similar to this involving people who have suffered similar fates in other parts of the world. What are we talking about there?
We represent people who have been disappeared in a lot of different areas. I mean, there's, like I mentioned before, there's a team that works on human trafficking. There's a team that works on people who have been disappeared in Saudi Arabia, political prisoners in Saudi Arabia, things like that. There's also a team that's working on what's happening here in the United States on our southern border with the camps, that ICE has essentially opened.
So it is wide-ranging work around this kind of humanitarian theme. Let's learn more about specifically what you and your team members are doing. For instance, on behalf of this specific Uyghur family with several family members who apparently are at the moment being held in these re-education camps in China. What is the nature of the work that you are doing in terms of trying to tell their story and perhaps work incrementally towards them someday being liberated?
Yeah, so we've been doing a bunch of different stuff. Pretty much everything we do could be considered advocacy work. So we reach out to media like we're doing right now here. I've reached out to a bunch of different places as well that write articles and do news stories and things like that. We do email campaigns. So we sent out a human rights survey to a bunch of different organizations. We found a giant list of all of these companies that are U.S.-based that do business in China and actually make their products in China a lot of the time. So we sent that out, and then we also CC'd in a bunch of different Chinese government emails, like the Chinese consulate that's in Chicago and a couple other consulates that are throughout the United States. So we wanted them to know that we know what they're doing, and we know of specific people that have been disappeared, and we want to know where those people are. And I think that reaching out to private organizations is one way that we can do that, simply because one of the things that China really cares about is its economy. And so that is one of the things that is going to sting the most if we can kind of try and affect that in any sort of way. We have since revamped our actual human rights survey, and we haven't done it yet, but we have a new version of it now, and we're going to start sending it out to all of these companies again that were on this list, you know, that are operating in China. And we are going to publish the results of that human rights survey, what they tell us in terms of, hey, you know, what's your human rights policy? You know, do you have any concern over what's happening in China while you're actually operating in China and doing business, you know, with the Chinese Communist Party, essentially? And so we're going to publish that, and we're going to give them 30 days to give us an answer. And if they don't give us an answer, we're going to publish that too.
That they've refused to answer.
Yeah, essentially that they're non-compliant with the human rights survey. Other things that we've done are contact different human rights groups like Amnesty International. Amnesty International had a form that we had some of the family members actually sign to give Amnesty International permission to document the disappearances of the people that are in this family. So they are compiling a report. I've contacted the International Red Cross. I've contacted the Senate Office for the Committee on Foreign Relations, different senators, you know, so there's a bunch of different avenues that we can go down when we're doing this type of advocacy work, and not all of it is always going to be successful. Advocacy work is often really time-consuming and really slow, and a lot of the times you don't actually see the you know, things come to fruition, but every now and then something does, and that's really, you know, what we're looking for is that one thing that helps us move the goalposts just a little bit each time.
Right. And it sounds like from the way you were describing this, particularly before we went on the air, that some of this is really designed so that the Chinese government knows that we know.
Yeah.
About this, because one can well imagine how they jump to conclusions about just how secret this can be or how unknown this can be to the rest of the world, especially if these re-education camps, as I suspect they are located in remote areas of China. It would seem far away from the prying eyes of the outer world. And in fact, that's not the case. In fact, people do know that these camps exist and at least know something of what happens there. And it's important that we let the Chinese government know that there is this level of awareness, a level of awareness that you're going to work really hard to elevate even further.
Yeah. Yeah. To be totally honest, they're really not in remote areas. A lot of the time,
the camps, they're
in the middle of cities. There was actually a, if you've ever heard of Vice News on HBO, they did a really, really good episode where they had journalists go into China and they took video secretly of some of these re-education camps. And the ones especially for children were pretty chilling. They were large pink castle-like structures, you know, with what looked like pictures of almost like Disney cartoons and things like that on them. But they were surrounded by barbed wire, and they had guard towers with guards that had guns inside of them and things like that. But they're located right in the middle of cities, and people that are in these communities know what's happening.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting wrinkle that I did not expect. How many of these camps do we know how many of these camps exist,
man.
Or is it hard to even know? Hard to fathom a guess?
You know, I'm not sure. I don't know how many of the camps exist, but I know that it's quite a few of them. It has to be a lot of them because of the sheer number of people that are in the camps right now. Like I said, it's between 1.5 and probably 2 million people that are being detained in them at the moment.
Right. So, and do we have any sense of how long people tend to be interred, or is it very hard to know that? I mean, are people being held in these camps for months, years, decades potentially? Do we know that?
Well, so it hasn't been going on decades yet.
Oh, yeah, that's right. It has not been going on that long.
Yeah, this has been going on since between 2016 and 2017 is when people really started to disappear from their communities.
So in a sense, it's probably impossible at this point to kind of know sort of the ultimate timeline that this is going to involve with people.
Yeah.
And if ultimately people are going to be released from these camps when it appears that they have been re-educated, so to speak, I suppose at this point it might be premature to even fully understand how all of this is going to play out in that respect.
It is difficult to understand, but there are people that have been put into the internment camps that actually have been released. It's not a large number of them by any means, but I mentioned earlier that they have an allotted hour every 2 weeks that they're given to cry. And that was by a report of a woman who was released from the camps, and she just fled. She fled out of China, and I believe she's living in Turkey right now. So there are people that are being released from the camps. I think it was probably about a month, maybe a month and a half ago, China actually came out with an official report, and they said, hey, we released all of the Uyghurs. And then basically every human rights organization came out, or every major human rights organization came out and refuted the claim. Amnesty International pushed out an article that was saying it. A couple others did as well. And I mean, we know that they're not being released simply based off of the fact that the people that I know still can't get in contact with their family members. Why would they, you know, not contact their family if they were released from the concentration camps? You'd think that that would be the first thing that people would do.
Right. So they are apparently remaining very much out of reach. So this is still a situation of grave concern, especially for the family members whose families are trying to learn their ultimate fate. I think you were saying that there is a resource available in which people can seek out some of these Uyghur testimonies and stories and so on. Where would you direct people to kind of explore more of this?
Yeah, so one place that you can actually go is to our website. So that's raisethevoices.org. And we have two things on there that you can read. We have a testimony by a woman named Golroy, who is the main family member of the three people that I mentioned earlier. She's like our contact. And so her story is on our website, and you can go and you can read it there. I believe it's called Loved Ones in East Turkestan or something of that nature. And then there's also another one that you can go and read called A Brief History of Xinjiang, Uyghur Populations and the Current Chinese Reeducation Camps. And that's just like a brief one-pager that gives you all the background on this entire situation. As far as other testimonies go, there's two places that I would recommend. There is Uyghur Pulse, which is a YouTube page, and that is YouTube videos of a bunch of people who have had their family members disappeared, and they're talking about their family members, and they're showing pictures, and you know, you can get all of the information straight from the source that way. The other place that I would recommend if you want to check out different testimonies is a place called the Xinjiang Victims Database, which you can find if you just Google that, the Xinjiang's Victims Database. And that has over 5,000 testimonies that have been collected from Uyghurs who have had their family members disappeared into the camps. Some of them are in Uyghur. Some of them are in Mandarin. Some of them are in English. It's, you know, kind of across the board in terms of the different languages that they're in. But you can go and check them out there.
Interesting. And what is your advice for anybody listening who finds their own sense of concern really sort of triggered by this, or at the very least the curiosity piqued, beyond learning more about this? Are there ways in which ordinary citizens can, in a sense, be part of this same advocacy effort on behalf of the Uyghur in China?
Yeah, I mean, you can, if you really want to, you could volunteer with us. So you can go to volunteermatch.org. And you can type in Raise the Voices or CivWorks, and you can find ways to contact us on there. And, you know, once you sign up, we'll contact you within, usually it's like a day or two, and we'll onboard you onto our team, and we'll give you things to do. Other things that you can do or that we can do as a country are right now there's a thing actually going through Congress. It just passed the Senate. It's a bill called the Uyghur Human Rights Policy Act of 2019. And so that passed the Senate, and now it's going on to the House of Representatives. So you can call your local representatives and you can tell them that you want them to support this bill against the Uyghur Human Rights Policy Act of 2019. And essentially what that does is it directs different organs of the U.S. government, like the Director of National Intelligence, the FBI, the Department of State, and it makes it so that they can gather intelligence about what's happening to the Uyghurs in China, and in particular in these concentration camps, and then they can present that intelligence to Congress so that Congress can consider further action in the future. So that's one thing that we can do. Another thing that we can do is we can advocate for a thing called the Global Magnitsky Act. And just a little bit of background, in 2012, the Magnitsky Act was signed into law by President Obama, and it was mostly concerning something that happened in Russia. There was a gentleman with the last name of Magnitsky who used to be I believe he was a prominent accountant during the days of the USSR. And for one reason or another, he was brought into a prison, I think around like 2010, 2011, 2012, sometime around there. And he was beaten to death during interrogation. And it just so happened that he had a friend here in the United States who's a prominent businessman. He knew John McCain. And so he talked to John McCain, and John McCain and another gentleman who was a senator as well ended up drafting this thing called the Magnitsky Act, which allowed the U.S. government to put individual sanctions on people that were involved in the death of Magnitsky. And wow. And so it stopped them from entering the United States. It stopped them from being allowed to spend their money in the United States. And it stopped them from being able to access U.S. banking infrastructure around the world. And in 2016, that became the Global Magnitsky Act. And so now it doesn't just pertain to this singular case that happened with Magnitsky in Russia. It now pertains to any human rights violations that happen in any country around the world. Wow. And we can put individuals that are involved in human rights violations on this list and stop them from entering the United States, stop them from being able to spend their money here, and stop them from being able to access U.S. banking infrastructure, which is a really big deal. And I think it would, in a lot of ways, start to, if anything, make them realize that there are going to be real consequences to their actions in their own country.
That is very intriguing news indeed, and I have a feeling that you're sharing information here that is as new to our listeners as it is to me. And this is very, very interesting. It puts a different light on all of this, and certainly I can see how you hope that this can fold into the efforts that you have already made, for instance, on the behalf of the Uyghur in China who have in a sense disappeared. I'm just curious. I suspect that as you were doing your graduate work study, you perhaps had no specific interest in this kind of work, or has this for a while been something that you thought, or is this in a sense the happiest of accidents? I don't mean that the situation itself is happy, of course, but I can tell that you are doing work that means a lot to you, and do you sense that this might signal a little different direction that your life might take professionally, or is it hard to say?
You know, it's hard to say. I think human rights are something that I've always been really interested in, and I've always thought are really important. I mean, at the end of the day, they really are, I think, American ideals. Eleanor Roosevelt was the chair of, you know, the UN council that drafted the Declaration of Human Rights. And so I think as an American, at least to me, it's something that's always been fundamental and important and something that we need to support. I've, you know, sort of dawdled with the idea of at some point going back to law school for international human rights. But during my time in graduate school, when I was getting my master's in public administration from DePaul, I did do work with refugees. I did my internship at a place in Chicago called Refugee One, which is a fantastic organization. It's a resettlement agency, and I primarily worked with the kids at the after-school program that were there.
Wow.
And then I did my thesis on the finances of Syrian refugees in the Chicagoland area post the 2016 U.S. presidential election.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I've always had an interest in it, and I think that I'm going to continue doing this work in some capacity, really, you know, no matter what job I end up getting. But, yeah.
Well, it's great to hear the way in which you have put your heart and soul into this really important work, again, on behalf of the nonprofit group Raise the Voices. And one more time, the website address for Raise the Voices for people wanting to seek more information.
Yeah, so it's just raisethevoices.org, and that's where you can see all the different publications that we've put. There's probably, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 of them, something like that at this point. And again, if you want to volunteer with us, you can always go to volunteermatch.org. And you can type in Raise the Voices, you can type in civ.works, and stuff should come up on that website for you to be able to contact us.
Very good. Robert Haggerty Jr., a volunteer with Raise the Voices, we really appreciate you joining us today on The Morning Show, and certainly appreciate the good work that you are doing on behalf of this important cause. Thank you for being a guest on The Morning Show today,
yeah.
And best wishes to you and your colleagues.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Monday on The Morning Show, Linwood Barclay, best-selling novelist. His latest book is a thriller called Elevator Pitch. It is set in Manhattan. Imagine if there were terrorists who were able to manipulate elevators in and around Manhattan. It's a thrilling book. Tuesday, Dr. Art Sear, his monthly visit to the program offering analysis of current events. On Wednesday, Ian Hutchison, an expert on the history of board games, talks about his a wonderful book about games, and his own collection of more than 1,000 games. Nan Calvert is here on Thursday with her monthly environmental program. She will have with her Don DeMute from the EcoJustice Farm Corps. A week from today, Clive Wynn, author of Dog is Love, Why and How Your Dog Loves You. And we remind you that tomorrow, the podcast edition of The Morning Show, again, will feature the morning show that aired 20 years ago today, a very special memorial tribute to longtime WGTD News Director Bill Guy, the creator of The Morning Show.